I've been looking at these very small scale mines that line most of the roads where I live, and sometimes there could just be tests for what's there under the ground, or sometimes they're actually digging for gravel, which is then used to make the roads. So they're often really close to highways or just sort of off them.
So it's a farm to table gravel experience. Like they don't ship it out very far.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. Like, do you see them around New South Wales?
I can't think of that as a thing.
I think in the half-hour drive between where I live and the town of Kununurra, there could be at least 10. Like, and I think that's a really conservative number.
Wow, yeah, that's not an image I'm familiar with at all. But that's the thing with the East Coast, right? They want their ugly stuff kept out of sight.
Yeah, and in that half-hour drive, like, there's not a lot of people actually living in that space, especially compared to somewhere like New South Wales. So it's generally considered a place where ugly stuff can be. When I look at these gravel pits, they feel to me like little cigarette burns piercing a tortured body or a tortured landscape, in the sense that they're small but perpetual and kind of persistently painful, searing. I think this analogy came to me from Kashmir, in particular a friend who had brought to my attention through his writing and art the Indian state's use of cigarette burns to torture people.
Where my parents live in Castlemaine, which is in the old heart of the gold rush in Victoria, the land is still so scarred and traumatised by the gold rush. Everything was turned up. It's so rare to see a tree in that area that's older than 100 years because they ripped so much out of the ground. And then once they pulled the gold out, they just left it. So there are holes everywhere. There's really weird craters in the earth. So it's pockmarked. It's got the weirdest feeling. It's still really beautiful country and strong country. And every now and then you see a tree that where the diameter is, you know, as big as this room. And you can imagine what it must have been like 150 years ago before they just marauded through and got rid of almost every tree. It's really a strange area, and these images are reminding me of that. And so these colour images, have they been taken near where you live too?
Yeah, this is about an hour from where I live. It's in what was a privately owned, or what is a privately owned cattle station turned kind of tourism park.
Oh, so do people have to pay to enter?
Yeah, I think you're actually meant to get a permit to enter. It's mostly where white people go. Like, although I've been living in the region for almost 10 years, I didn't really have that social group who pulled me to this place. I first went there in 2019. I knew I wanted to make a work like this, and as soon as I got there, I knew that this was kind of the place to do it. All the violence within this really tries to capture that sense of entitlement in which non-Indigenous people approach places like this. I'm not saying that this place is especially sacred, but coming more from the premise that, like, all of this continent is special, and that the way people are behaving here is just an example of how we behave everywhere. And today, I guess the only reason we can sit in places like this without fear is because of all the violence that has come before, the frontier wars and all of that. But, like, this violence exists in an ongoing sense too. Springs kind of right across the Kimberley are places that white people really gravitate towards. In the first conversation from this series, I said there's, like, not many Aboriginal people who go to these sorts of places. And my partner, Chris, who is Mirrawong and Ngalliwuru, kind of interrupted me and said there are never Aboriginal people at these springs.
So what's going on with that? Where are the black fellas hanging out in the heat?
I guess in, like, saltwater fishing spots where they get more fish, and also a lot of black fellas don't always have access to vehicles that would get them to places like this. And so they might fish a lot closer to town. Or a lot of them who do have vehicles tend to go places like...
Are there spots where tourists don't know about that are kind of safer or...
Yeah, there's that too. Like, there is a spot that we go to, which is behind my in-laws' block, about an hour or so drive. And that's a freshwater permanent spring with turtles. And so we fish for turtles there. And we're pretty much the only people that go there. That's my mother-in-law's place and her mother's place. But it is complicated. Like, do you remember that article I wrote about the dam wall? That was how we first made contact. So
Kununurra
was created in the 60s, and the colonists wanted to kind of shift the economy from pastoralism to agriculture. So they made a giant dam, and the township was birthed from there. There's a really incredible report that I wrote about in that article. It was produced by the Kimberley Land Council. It's a social and economic impact assessment of stage one of the Ord River irrigation scheme and its impact on the local Aboriginal people. In that report, there are quotes from the old people who say really clearly that when the town of Kununurra was made and a much bigger non-Indigenous population moved in, Mirrawong people lost control of their water places. I feel like it's something not spoken about a lot, and this is just like my assumption, but I think part of it, like a lot of it is, like my partner, for instance, is often just more interested in going to places where he can actually get fish, and a lot of springs are not fishing places. But I think it's also coupled by access to the kind of vehicles that are required to get you to these places. And that brings us to wealth inequity and a culture of leisure. Like there's normally a lot of white people there, which really sort of makes blackfellas like my partner feel heaps less comfortable. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. I also wonder, looking at these images and the very loud absence of black bodies and people of colour more broadly, I suppose, if there are conversations and understandings around who should be there anyway, right? Like women's places, men's places, sacred places, all those understandings of place that actually mean that the amount of people that might feel comfortable there is a lot smaller from a community level. Because, I mean, if you don't have a responsibility to this place or a connection to this place, you might be like, oh, well, why would I go to that country?
Yeah, exactly. And when I shot these, I was there with my partner and his mom and my stepson. And although it's like relatively close to home, they'd never been there either. It's not their country. And my mother-in-law, well, she enjoyed the water and she enjoyed being there, but she went there with a real uncertainty. And she kept looking at me and looking around and saying, this has got to be a dreaming spot. I think that sense of hesitation or self-awareness is what the majority of non-Indigenous people lack in their movement here. And I guess through my work, I'm trying to highlight the behaviour of my own, like, white culture and make a lot of these less visible and violent things that we might not see in ourselves to try and make that more legible to ourselves. The WA government are trying to push changes to the Aboriginal Heritage Act in WA at the moment because the current legislation is crap. But like the new legislation they're proposing is also crap, and part of it will require that sites have to be registered and publicly accessible.
What? Why? What's the logic? Do you know?
So then, I mean, anyone...
Apart from the violent colonial extraction settler logic, of course.
Their logic is that if they're all registered, they can better be managed, at least more legible to the government system. But what so often happens when sites are publicly known, they're often desecrated. Another thing I've been looking at through my work, especially through my residency with the KLC, are Section 18 forms, which are what people currently fill out if they want to damage or destroy an Aboriginal site in WA. So there's a PDF.
To download in a printable form.
Yeah, and it's like...
That you might use to register your intent.
It's more than registering intent. It's to seek permission. I shared it with a friend and he was like, fuck, this is simpler than an arts funding application. And it is.
But do you have to show that you've done any research?
Well, part of that research involves looking up the sites on a register.
Okay.
But like a lot of Indigenous people don't want to register sites.
Of course.
I've been told the new Heritage Act is going to make compulsory for Aboriginal people to register sites, so then companies can just sort of go through a search engine, and if there's no site registered on the land, then they can proceed.
But it's all sacred. It's all
exactly. Exactly.
It's all country, right? So why? That doesn't make sense to me that if you're actually following that line of logic, everything would be registered. And so, I mean, is that the great way to take down big mining? Can we just register everything?
Well, we could try. I really love the opening of Amblin Quay Molina's book. She writes, "There's no part of this place that was not, is not cared for, loved by an Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander nation. There are no trees, rivers, hills, stars that were not and are not someone's kin." For me, that kind of just is what sits in permanent opposition to all of these attempts by Australian law and also anthropological processes of registering sites, which really try and demarcate some sense that Aboriginal land, or specifically like the sacredness of it, is something that exists here, but not here. My images are trying to illustrate a kind of cultural attitude that really runs in opposition to these words from Amblin. Like, I've had white people unsettled by these images say, as though it's a game in which they're trying to outsmart each other, "Oh, but like, how do you know that they're not Aboriginal people? I mean, the people in my pictures. You can't judge just by the color of someone's skin." And I get that, but I think these photos are of a certain cultural attitude.
And I mean, I should say I've done this. I've been to Kakadu without friends local to the area to guide us and us through the places that we were and weren't allowed to be. So we just did the thing that was on the tourist map. And those places were always really violated by the tourism. And part of me was hoping that these four spots that are all picked out on the map are like bait for tourists, which let other places not be hung in this way. There were some spots where it was really lovely to walk along and see a creek or a billabong and think, "Oh, that's beautiful. I don't need to go in that water, but I'm happy it's here." And then there were other places where I'd walk along and be like, I really shouldn't be here. It's time to go now. And it's just being aware of that stuff. It's like being able to have an intuition. Is it an intuition? I don't know. An awareness that triggers those responses that maybe, I don't know, do white fellas not have? Or maybe they do and they don't know that that feeling is something they should listen to. Maybe it's been coded out of folk.
Yeah, I think this is where it gets really interesting and complicated. Non-Indigenous artists often speak about how their relationship with place informs their work. And often people speak in really felt bodily ways about this. I get really torn because I feel really conflicted about how we can even begin to. I mean, I think place becomes a bit of a code word for avoiding a term like country, which white people can use to talk about the land we are on, as though it's not Aboriginal land. How do non-Indigenous people possibly have a relationship with this land and this country that we're on that's not inherently violent? But then another part of me wonders if I'm getting too pessimistic and should we actually rejoice in people who embrace this place?
It's something I think about a bit because it seems to imply that there is a dichotomy, right? That there's people and then there's place and not an understanding that country is both. There's this thing that I hear city folk saying a lot and I'm constantly fascinated by it. And when I look at these pictures of yours, I hear these conversations. Settler folk who live in the city will say, "I was on country," and then they'll go and tell a story about being out in the bush and they'll finish it up and, you know, then it will end with, "Oh, and then I came back to Sydney," which is so bizarre, right? Because all of this is country, including the place where you're living, which is the place you have a responsibility to. There is such a fundamental lack of understanding about what country is, which is so apparent when people frame it as being a place over there, which is how I think a lot of settler and white folk think. A lot of time in the city, which is where I live and I've lived for a long time now, seems to always frame the place that's out of sight and the place that they don't understand as being Aboriginal. And the place where they live is so unquestionably theirs and they have ownership that is, you know, all of 200 years old or whatever, which then entitles them to erase the Black bodies and Black agency from that place. And part of this whole thing that I find so interesting is how these narratives are deployed by these, I don't know, well-meaning, quote-unquote, woke fellas who, like, they want to get it. They say, "I was on country," and I think, "Oh, I guess fucking good for you, but why? Why are you trying to, what are you trying to get at in this moment?" Because I want you to hear the dissonance. And it's that thing that you were talking about. It's like, want to think that we can get to a place where things are better, but is it actually antithetical to live in a settler colonial state that's never signed a treaty, that is here illegally? Can we ever come to a place where the occupants of that system can act ethically?
Yeah, like that's where I am too, and I don't know what to do. What you say about people placing country elsewhere, I get a lot of that because of where I live. People are like, oh, you're so lucky you live on country. And I'm like, Sydney, Melbourne, Perth, it's country as well. But that wasn't something I guess I always knew. And so I have to remind myself to respect people's learnings, right?
Mm-hmm.
I first sort of encountered it when I moved to Warman in 2011. And
was that the year of the big flooding?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. That would have been really intense.
Yeah, it was. Like, I'd been in Warman for about 8 months and kind of just been thrown in here with a new job after a flood had ravaged the whole community. And after about 8 months, I went to Perth with some Gidja artists, and it was my first time back out of the region. I felt really weird because I'd never been to Perth before. And during those 8 months in Warman, we were perpetually welcomed basically to every new creek or place that we went. Every place involved a new welcoming with smoke or water, and people would tell me, like, you're okay here now. And so when we went to Perth, I suddenly had this big feeling of worry that I hadn't been welcomed here. It was the first solid, I mean, I'd always been aware that this was Aboriginal land, but it was the first really bodily feeling through which I realized I was actually walking on places that I don't know and that could be dangerous. I realized I didn't know if this place was gender restricted or harmful or not, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I really started to worry about what I'm violating here in Perth.
And also, when you're not known to the land, you enter this kind of super fractured relationality where country can't recognize you in return. Even if you're in a place where you may have access or the permissions to be there, you know, from a gender or cultural standpoint.
Yeah, I think that feeling that I had way back then is something that's fermented and is coming out in my work now. But there was this old man there in Perth too. I didn't know him. Like, he was from the desert. And I remember being on a bus with all the Aboriginal artists traveling to an event. And he was telling everyone, be careful, there are little people around here and they're going to get you. He totally had that sense that he was in another person's country and had to look out for himself and other people. Well, for me, that feeling was something very new. And that's connected to what you were saying about how city folks say they've been out on country while being blind to the fact that they're actually permanently on country. And sometimes people look at these photos and think I'm talking about tourists violating a particular place without kind of seeing that I'm trying to talk about something much broader.
Yeah, that makes sense. I lived in the Blue Mountains for a little while. We were living right at the edge of the national park, and there's very little acknowledgement of Aboriginal people there. At best, it's usually one of those really weird shanty signs at the entrance that will say some gammon thing like, oh, Aborigines lived here for maybe upwards of a limited amount of time that we're going to give them, like, you know, 4,000 years or whatever it is, whatever shit it is. And it'll say, you know, they survived as hunter-gatherers and full stop. And now we'll tell you about who discovered this place. It's those sorts of signs that are around there. And it's an area that's really controlled. People can go here and people can't go here, that sort of national park. And it's driven by this idea that you keep something safe by not allowing humans to go there. It feels like an obvious thing to say, but that understanding of place, I think, really, really poisons our society at large. A belief that there is no way that humans can live peacefully or live respectfully or live in relationship and responsibility to place. And the violence inherent in that against Indigenous people is really obvious. Because how can you enter a place where people aren't given access to their country and not respected for their knowledge of country? But you also do this thing where you tell settlers that there's no way of understanding place, like you can't be trusted with this at all. And in a lot of ways, they can't, because there's an evidence base of like 230 odd years of people doing really bad stuff. But on the other hand, if you don't give people the tools to understand their responsibilities to the place where they live, I don't know, is that optimistic to think that if you educated people, they would treat places with the respect it deserves, or know that I don't need to go to that waterhole. I know that it's there and I know it's not for me. I don't know, maybe that's too at odds with the sort of exploration and extractive system that's really been coded into this society.
I feel like I want to hold on to optimism. Like, I feel like it's important, but I do get stuck in the impossibility of it because the structures of settler colonialism are just so heavy. I'm not sure how to move ethically or respectfully as a larger society. I read your piece on the Cordite Poetry Review on that family in Tasmania, a case study on the colony.
Oh yeah, that's a true story actually. I saw this real estate listing last year for a property in Tassie that was for sale for the first time for $12 million. Like, how can people not see the absurdity of this?
Yeah, it felt like such an apt summary of what we're trying to talk about. In that piece, you talk about the stealing of land and sketch out a narrative of how the selling of that stolen land is basically unethical, questioning how it's legally possible to sell something stolen. But what you're doing is pulling out the everyday of settler colonialism, whereby people take their ownership of property and houses, the basic ability to buy a house as
a right.
A right, something given, something with such a seemingly natural sense of entitlement.
I'm so fascinated by that logical fallacy of it's my right to own land and it's my right to sell that land. Because if you live with that belief as really inherent to your societal values, how is it that you could abide by land being stolen so recently and not be outraged by that?
Yeah, but that concept of something being recent is really subjective. Like, your recent is really not my dad's recent. Your recent to my dad is the distant past that he doesn't have to think about so much now because things have apparently moved on from there.
Yeah, like the get over it sort of attitude.
Yeah, my dad wouldn't say it so brutally, but...
But that's the government attitude, right?
Yeah, which is why when you were talking about those national park signs of the three sentences that state that Aboriginal people like once wandered here, compared to the three paragraphs detailing the lives of the explorers who apparently discovered it. Like, we don't have government energy going towards properly amending any of this.
Because it doesn't suit. I guess land ownership is a microcosm, an example of the thing that the Australian colony is. And of course it makes sense that any challenge to a piece of land can only be understood as a challenge to the settler state. And the government recognising that challenge would be too big a reckoning. Feels pertinent having this sort of conversation against the backdrop of the occupation that's really hitting the news at the moment due to what's happening in Sheikh Jarrah, with a lot of violence and what feels like the most awareness of that situation I can ever remember happening in my adult life. I mean, the state of the Israeli occupation of Palestine, of Palestinian land, has been a state of violence for the last 73 years. It's something that has been going on for a long time, but is so outrageously underreported by so many news sites because the subject is simply too antithetical to colonialism more broadly. I know people like to say that we're living in a post-colonial society, but I just don't think that's correct.
Yeah, me neither.
And so it would be too uncomfortable for all these colonial states to talk about the situation in Palestine without recognizing their own illegitimacy and without systemic change and broader political recognition. What is the point of democracy? I just keep coming back to this, right? It's a trap. It's like a sugar trap where you think you've been given all that you need, or you've been told that you've been given the thing that you need and that allows you certain rights. But the person who has given you these so-called rights is so invested in you not having any agency that it's a lie.
A few days ago, I saw a Palestinian poster from the 70s and it has really just stuck with me. It didn't shock me. It just made me sad because of how long this has been going on and how much cultural energy has gone into narrating, advocating, supporting Palestine. And yet what we see now in Sheikh Jarrah continues. And for those reasons exactly, that's why I'm extending these conversations out to friends in Kashmir as well, because what we're talking about here is connected to what's happening there. Obviously different contexts, but there's a lot of resonances and potential strength too. When you asked, is having faith in education too hopeful? I think it's all we have. And one component of education is curriculum in schools. But it's also about something broader, fostering a really big shake-up of things so apparently solid as worldviews, our very ways of thinking. It's not just about understanding history, but reckoning with the forms of extraction and notions of ownership. Everything that forms the foundation of the majority of people's mindsets in Australia and those who dominate much of the world.
I agree. I do think that education is realistically the only tool, and the ethics of that is a really interesting space. But we have to be optimistic, right? Because otherwise it's too fucking depressing. I used to run a kindergarten program for little kids that was like a decolonial sovereignty class for settler kids living in Melbourne. And it was so fun. But it was this really interesting thing where all these kids were of a certain class, more or less, sort of inner city, left-leaning parents who were settlers and not necessarily white. We didn't have any Indigenous kids in the class, which wasn't necessarily deliberate, but more reflective of these being the sorts of conversations the Indigenous four-year-olds don't need to be having. And this was a class to say, hey, everyone, you're on Aboriginal land. And they'd be like, okay. And when you explain the idea that land is stolen to a four-year-old, they're just like, oh, that's bad. Because even by that age, you have a moral compass and a version of understanding what is right and wrong. And that's clearly wrong. And I think when you establish that at a young age, it's really simple. Because a lot of kids at that point, they haven't been coded within the racism of the state yet. I don't think that this class of a couple dozen kids was particularly radical, but I do think those sort of actions are increasingly happening, and it has to start at that early education, early childhood place. Because when you're telling an 18-year-old who's just started uni about Aboriginal Australia, they often say, oh, well, fuck off, that doesn't matter, that's old news, get over it. And you've gotten them too late. Not always, but I think it's that foundational stuff that builds respect and builds an ethical framework. I think there's a conundrum there, but one that can be resolved because it has to be.
Yeah. When I was installing my work here at Carriageworks, thinking a lot about this conversational component and what the work means, I decided to read this book by Patti Smith, Year of the Monkey, just to take my mind off so much of what I was working with. There's this anarchist academic I really love, James C. Scott, who advocates for always reading outside of your discipline. Like, so here I was delving into Patti, one of my creative idols, like wanting to be taken to a different world. But the underpinning current of the book is her desire to visit Ayers Rock, which she calls Ayers Rock, and this current of like dreaming, you know?
Oh, wow.
You can imagine her style, like it's written in this very fluid way between dreams and wakefulness. And part of that comes from this Western concept of dreams, of being awake and asleep. But then she also kind of goes occasionally into this Indigenous dreaming thing a little bit with her aspiration to get to Ayers Rock. Like once or twice she used the Indigenous term Uluru, but it was mostly Ayers Rock. And I was like, fuck, I can't escape this thing. It's everywhere. Like, no doubt, I find Patti Smith such a big source of inspiration. But then I see her enacting things in this case that made me feel really uncomfortable.
That reminds me, I've spent a bit of time in the US and have Native American friends. And we were at a festival in Oregon one week, and I spoke about how weird it was that there'd been no acknowledgement of whose land it is. But my Native friends were really shocked that an acknowledgement would be something of a norm in Australia. The Pacific Northwest is a very different context, but it is fascinating to me how different and similar these conversations often seem. And these ideas around occupation are inescapable, right, in these settler colonial states.
Yeah, I found too people outside Australia have conversely been confronted sometimes by what they perceive as the superficiality of acknowledgements of country that they've seen play out at official events. Like sometimes commenting that Australia's really good at pretending that they're embracing Aboriginal people or culture, which is in many ways true, but I also think it's a practice that people from outside Australia are not that familiar with.
I was at an event recently where a local Liberal MP had been asked to speak, and at the start a local elder got up and did a welcome, and then the MP got up and was like, oh, thanks so much for that welcome. Oh, they really do encourage us to give welcomes, but I would rather not because I don't really feel comfortable doing it. I was like, oh, you've totally misunderstood the difference between a welcome versus an acknowledgement of country, which is troubling. And then to also in the same breath be like, I don't like doing it. I'm encouraged to, but it's not compulsory. Basically, he was saying it's a token that I don't care for. And this was at a bullshit harmony event, and everyone was just nodding along with the good white guy. It's so complex.
Yeah, I often feel nervous when I do acknowledgements because I want to try and make it not tokenistic, and I don't think that's really very easily done. But it's actually also probably good that it's not easily done. Like, we need to do the hard work. I was reading the summary of your book that will soon be released, How to Make a Basket, and it spoke of protest and love and relationships and how these things run through your work. I'm interested to hear from you about that relationship between all this difficult stuff and the joyful.
Yeah. There's an academic from Turtle Island, North America, called Daniel Heath Justice. And he said this line in an essay that I really like, that so often we think of the definition of the Native experience as being defined by violence and being defined by deficit. And when we allow ourselves to be defined by those things, we disallow spaces for joy and love and beauty and independence. I'm paraphrasing, but it's something I think about a lot. It is really hard to live in a colony like Australia, but there's so much more to existence than constantly being oppressed by the settler state. And I think the most radical act of protest that Indigenous people often do is existing with joy that is undiminished by the colony, loving and being loved, having lives that are full of love and humour and joy, which is what all of our lives are. And to allow the colony to take those things away would be to give the colony the ultimate power, right?
True.
There's a defiance in that, and it becomes radical. It becomes a radical sort of love and a radical sort of joy to live with those things under a state of oppression. And I think when you have those things, then you have the power to fight with
more vigour.
More vigour, yeah, and more ability. And you become refreshed, and there is a bigger picture. Like that thing that we're talking about before, it does get really dark if you ponder on it for too long, and it can feel really hopeless. And I think Black communities are not defined by hopelessness. They're defined by so much more. And I want to always be making space for that and constantly checking myself, because it can become really despairing, and I don't want to let the colony have that too.
Yeah, in my work, I tend to think more about the non-Indigenous audience of my work than I really do think about Indigenous audiences of this work. And I feel like a lot of what I'm saying is stuff that many Indigenous people already know in their own way, whereas I really feel a need to make it legible to non-Indigenous people who don't already know or feel it. But sometimes non-Indigenous people can feel like it's too confronting and difficult, so they pull away. But I feel like we need to move into that space to be able to move away from it as well. Otherwise, it will just keep fermenting under the surface. I often feel a hesitation around the idea of national harmony and reconciliation. But then I do hear Indigenous people speaking in really positive and powerful ways about how this nation can come together in beautiful ways through a kind of true reckoning with what has happened and is happening.
And while I completely agree with that, I don't think it can be swept under the rug either. Like, we can't just move forward laughing and smiling. We need our warriors strong. Really, without a robust treaty, this country is kind of doomed.
Yeah, when I first put the pictures of all the violence within this on my social media a few years ago, I included a quote from Evelyn Araluen, which basically said, "Do you know what laws I've had to learn while you play in everything they protect?" Quite a few non-Indigenous people commented along the lines of, like, "What are you saying? Should we all just leave this country? Like, I was born here. I've got nowhere else to go." And although practically I know that it's an impossibility, I also think it's something worth imagining and sitting with. Like, to really think about why it could be a necessity, even if it is an impossibility. Like, I'm just thinking out loud with you now, but I think there is some value in us going to these uncomfortable places that may unsettle so much the things we take to be foundational. But I think there is a value in that, which could ultimately enrich our lives, if that's the right way to put it.
Yeah, I've tried to write stories about this in the past, imagining an extraction of non-Indigenous folk from the continent. And to be honest, I don't actually like where it goes. When you follow that line of logic to the finish point, I start thinking, well, okay, well, if I don't like this and I don't like how it began, so how far back can I follow this? What if all the settlers left? I mean, aside from being fucking impossible, I have settler ancestors as well as Indigenous ancestors, so I would cease to exist. Do I ship off a leg back to Ireland? And so many people I love are settlers, and the ones who I love are so often grappling with these things too. There is also the folk who are living in Australia due to displacement from their own homelands, often because of wars that this government here is implicated in. We need this place to be a safe home for all the people who are here. It's not that there is a solution to these problems, but being aware of them is so critical to collective action. And when you start thinking of one element of these things, you start seeing the interrelation and the intersectionality of all the broader systemic issues. I mean, I get really frustrated with like eco-activists who aren't advocating for Indigenous rights, for example. I think it's those tiers of deeper engagement, collective action, where we find the ability to solve so many of these issues simultaneously. I've written a piece about this that's set in the future, looking back at solving the problems of our society. When I initially sat down to write a piece about my version of a utopia, at first all I could think about was how much work it would take to get there. But I can also imagine a place of being older and looking back and being like, oh, I remember the bad old days of capitalism, of housing insecurity, homophobia, racism, the climate crisis, etc. And being able to consider the ways that some of these problems have shared solutions and they are within our grasp. That does give me hope.
Yeah, and now, like, my son is growing up with far more positive and strong visibility of Indigenous people, like so much more than his father or his grandparents ever had when they were young.
And we're like the fastest growing population on this continent, which is so deadly. Another generation of warriors who might not have to fight the same fight, but move on to the next one. And it might not have to be so hard. It's that future, those young ones, that make this current fight worth it, that make the whole thing hopeful.